Now, one more verse.
What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun?
All right, so if I were going to write you a letter, and I said, this is my best wisdom as a preacher, Jack Afer, after 30 years of preaching, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Would you be interested in reading the rest of the letter?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Just because it came from me, I know. Because this sounds like this is going to be depressing. This is going to be dismal. This is going to be, I mean, life is tough enough. I don't need any more of your despair or your drama. So we might just skip right over it. But actually, it's exactly the opposite. This book can be the most freeing, the most inspiring, because it helps us focus on what is really important. And of course, we're going to be given an answer right here up front. When he says all is vanity, we have to qualify that. What does he mean by that? And we're going to qualify it. And it's qualified by this question that he asks, which is, what profit does a man have for his work which is done under the sun? We have to understand that phrase as well. But as we begin to do so, we're going to set the context for this really investigative book of the wisest man in the world who's seeking out to find out the big answers in life. Like, what am I here for? What's the purpose and meaning of life? Is there anything to look forward to afterwards? And so it's a thrilling book because it really touches just each of our lives on a personal level. And also, it's probably a great book to start with people in the world who don't even want to acknowledge God, because this book is going to be, as we see, one of the most secular books in the Bible. Now, does that go together, books of the Bible and secular? Not really, does it? Because we think of secular books as non-biblical books. You know, there's 66 books in the Bible. They're all very spiritual. And so why would I say this is a secular spiritual book? Well, it is. You'll see why in just a second. Yes.
I usually start people that are having a Bible study with this book because, first of all, everybody in the world has heard of Solomon.
Yes.
And then secondly, he talks about things that are common to mankind.
All right. And we're going to see that. We can all relate to it, and that's very well said. So let's look at the first phrase, life under the sun, because in the Hebrews, they had a concept that's different than ours, and most of you are familiar with it, but of course we just have to draw it, that they viewed the earth pretty much as a flat little sphere right there. Well, not sphere, but circular orb, okay? Not even an orb. An egg. The middle would be the landmass, and there'd be water around it. But they saw Sheol, or the land of the dead, below. And then the skies would be the heavens, and then there would be the heavens above the heavens, which we would call the third heaven. So I want you to see this picture right here. So when we think of life under the sun, first of all, we live on this sphere, we know it is a sphere now, called Earth, and around it is atmosphere. Now that atmosphere is the air we breathe, and I don't remember how thick it is. Does anyone recall? How many miles does the atmosphere go up? A lot. Someone could look it up on Google real quick, but that's where the birds fly, and that's where the weather is and all that. That is called the first heaven. Now, when we think of heaven, we have to think, oh, that's where God is. No, that would be the first heavens. Now, do we use that language to describe the heavens other than the godly realm? Yeah, we do all the time, especially when we're thinking about this second heaven where the moons and the stars are. It said, oh, the heavens and the earth declare thy handiwork. Remember that in the book of Isaiah? When he speaks of the heavens and the earth, he's talking about the sun, the moon, and the stars, and all those majestic creations that are so large and so far apart, they just boggle our mind, and we realize that God just spoke them into existence. And so they declare how great he is. So the first heaven is where? The air that we breathe. The second heaven would be the universe. Now, what's on the outside edge of the universe? Now, you know I'm sure you all do from your physics class and latest discoveries. The universe is expanding, right? In other words, this line right here is moving outward. Yes?
According to Google, your light blue is 10 miles and your gray out there is
30 miles. All right. No, this gray, the universe, yes. It'd be light years.
It says atmosphere is 300 miles, but most of it's within 10 miles.
Okay, so the atmosphere is...
That would be 300.
300, the light blue would be
300. 300?
But most of it is compressed within the first 10.
Oh, 300 miles, she's saying, and the first is compressed within the first 10 miles. All right, because I think over 10 miles, yeah, you have to have oxygen support. So up to 300 miles, all right? But we're talking about light years from this edge to this edge, right?
Yeah.
Some of the stars are hundreds of light years away. Okay, so my question is this. What is this edge expanding into? Now, if you say it's expanding in the universe, you don't understand the question. That edge is the edge of the universe, right?
Nobody knows.
So whatever you want to call it, that is called the third heaven.
It's like asking if infinity expands
into
infinity.
Well, right. I just want you to see the stage that we're looking at. That's the heavenly realm. It's outside of space, time, and dimension. In the beginning, God created what? The heavens and the earth. He created the second heaven and the first heaven. Right? But what existed before time, space, and dimension? God. Eva, you had a comment?
If you're expanding, can't you be the same thing while you expand?
Well, no, I'm not.
Yeah,
I know, but you blow up a balloon, it's still a balloon, and the balloon is getting bigger. What is that balloon expanding into? Well, atmosphere. Well, it's not expanding atmosphere, that's down here. It's not expanding into more space, because that is space. So it boggles the mind, all right? Now, the reason I'll say that, where is life under the sun on that chart? Life under the sun is life lived not in the third heaven, not in the second heaven. Life under the sun is life lived on in the first heavens. It's those of us that are on this globe that has the sunshine on us. So life on the earth is a phrase to depict your life from birth to death as you live it on this earth. Life under the sun. That's what it depicts. It's symbolic for that period of time, however long or short it may be. So you all understand? Life under the sun speaks of your life as if there is no God. Now, is there a God? Yes. But the way Solomon is writing and looking at the big questions of life, he's asking them as if all we have is life under the sun. Now, in the end, he's going to add God back into the equation. But let's just remove God from the picture just to ask big questions. Why are we here and what's the meaning of life? And you know what the answer is? When you remove God from the picture, it's vanity. It's worthless. There's no purpose. You say, well, how could he say that? I disagree. Well, you stay with us in our class and you're going to go, oh, yeah. And it's going to drive everyone to look above the arch, above the heavens, and to look and ask the question, well, what is life above the sun like? Where can I find meaning there? What would life above the sun be? Well, it'd be in the third heaven, right? It's in the spiritual realm. And that's really going to be our answer, and we're going to see that as we introduce it. So any question about this? This phrase is used 29 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, every chapter except, I think, chapter 10. So he just keeps on referring to life under the sun, life under the sun, life under the sun. And he'll say, it's miserable. No, not every time, okay? So when we look at that concept, here you are living on the earth and you're living life under the sun. Isn't that a way, that's the way we're describing your existence. I know in the Northwest you don't have much life under the sun, but still the sun's out there, right? Okay. 29 times, you could find it and count them each one yourself. It speaks of life without God, and that's why it's called the most secular book in the Bible. Because Solomon is questioning life as if there is no God to see if we can find purpose and meaning without him. So it's taking a secular look at the world and the life which we live. Now, is he saying there is no God? No. He's just questioning life as if there is no God, and it's a secular view. Now, why is this important, and why would it be transferable to people out in the world that don't believe in there's a God? They ask the same questions, and the context in which they ask the question is, there is no God. They're searching for the same answer with the same perspective, there is no God. So why are we here? What are we supposed to do? What's right and wrong? What's the purpose and meaning of life? And so it's perfectly relative. It corresponds exactly to our secular world in which we live. Now, some of would argue about Ecclesiastes, even though it's an inspired book, not necessarily all his conclusions are inspired, because some of them fly in the face of the Christian worldview. Well, I'm going to suggest, I think his conclusions are inspired, because he makes his conclusions on the basis that there is no God. He's not saying they're true. He's just saying if you remove God from the picture, this is all you're left with, and you have to accept it. Okay? Then when you plug God back into the picture, that goes away. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. So that's why he says it's the most, and it asks life's most meaningful questions. Charles Swindoll writes this. One of the most convincing literary works, speaking of the book of Ecclesiastes, declaring that apart from God, there is no satisfaction in life. Yes?
Well, it seems to me, when I look at Ecclesiastes and consider Solomon, who was the wisest and wealthiest, it would heed my attention to listen to what he has to say.
Okay.
Because he's accumulated so much and knows so much, God has given him wisdom.
Well, you're getting ahead of me, so you're right.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. Okay, because you're exactly right. Why would you listen to him is what really I'm going to ask the question. You're getting to that. But look at verse 1 again. Here's the big... That's not... Verse 2, actually. 3. Wait. I don't even have my glasses on. Yeah, verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That's the New King James. The New American Standard says, what advantage? So basically this question is asking, when you're all done on this earth and you've spent 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years, and you compile all your labor, all your efforts, all your activities, and you pile them all up and you weigh them, and the question you ask is, what profit has it given you? What long-term advantage? What residual effect is it going to have for you that's positive? Is that a fair question? So basically, what's he asking by this question? What am I here for? How am I going to live a successful life? How could I take advantage of this opportunity, because it's so brief on this life, that I don't look back and say, boy, I wasted my life on things that are not important? Because we've all done that, and that's probably the scariest thing. To waste your life, because it's such a gift. And he says, that's my question. When I look at my life under the sun, and I ask the question, what can I do to make sure that it's profitable? Well, the answer is what? He already gave it. What? It's all vanity. There's nothing that's profitable. Absolutely zero. And that's why he said, well, it's going to be a depressing book. But this is the most freeing thing when you grasp the answer, because it's going to force us to look above the sun for meaning, and that's going to give us the freedom to finally enjoy what we have on this earth, because we're not looking to it to provide any meaning to our life. It's just a blessing we enjoy. Now, when you see that, boy, you have a biblical worldview. that just sets you free and puts some joy in your life. And that's what it does. All right? Because we live in a world that, you know, of academics, they have an increasingly number of professors are committing suicide. You know why that is? Well, they reject God largely. And they ask this question, and they know the answer. They're agreeing with Solomon that the answer is there's no real purpose to life because they have a worldview, there is no God. And so what do? How many celebrities and rich people end up taking their life? They seemingly have everything. So, well, that's true with people that don't have money. Well, that's true, I know. But all it comes down to, if it's not mental disease or something like that, it's despair because there's nothing satisfies. And they end up taking their life.
I just, on the same line, I'm just seeing in my profession increasing numbers of kids who just see what's the point of education.
That's right.
What good is it to me?
That's right. Yeah, because they're told, you know, consistently. Now, you say, well, let's just give simple answers to eat, drink, and be merry. Simple answers don't satisfy because, oh, yeah, you can give some trite cliche answers, you know, seek your own path and just find your own self. But when you find yourself, what do you discover? It's all vanity. It's just not satisfying. I don't even like myself. So what do you mean find myself? Is that not true? You know what I'm saying? And so they don't satisfy. And it's interesting, the slugger doesn't even ask. The slugger, I'm talking about the guy that's just kind of wallowing through life and eat, drink. Do they even bother to ask these kind of questions? They're the person that wakes up when they're 60 or 50, and if they're not in jail, they're broke, overweight, and, you know, physically broken down health-wise because what? They haven't dealt with these bigger questions in life, and they've just eat, drink, and been merry, and look where it's gotten them. So it's interesting. The people that ask this question is really going to be two categories, perhaps more, but break them down. Those that are seeking wisdom, they're trying to walk in such a way that will benefit them and make the most of the opportunity to give them this thing called life. Because it's the most precious commodity you have. It's more precious than wealth, building stuff, children, just the breath of air that you have made in the image of God. It's the most precious thing we have. So the wise man wants to know, how do I spend it wisely so it profits me in the end? And the other person is similar. It's often the broken. Often some people will say Solomon was probably in his 40s when he started writing this book or questioning life. What happens in your early 40s? Midlife crisis. A lot of people have said that. Midlife crisis. It's where all the world's or life's decisions have largely been made. What am I going to be when I grow up? Well, you've already done that. Who am I going to marry? Well, by 40, if you're not married and having kids, sorry, it's over. I know, I'm just speaking generally. But you have a wife, you have kids, you've got a home, at least in America, you've been working at the job for 20 years, and every Monday, what do? Go to work, get off on Friday, what do you do on Tuesday? Same thing over and over and over again. The sun rises, the sun sets, the rains come, the rains go. And it's just repetitive, it's boring, and it's unsatisfying. And so they get this midlife crisis. It's a real phenomenon, isn't it? All right? So some suggested that's Solomon. He's conquered almost everything in his life right now. And we're going to see that in a second. And he's going, is that it? Isn't there more here? Now, there's that young kid that just won last week that big Powerball lottery. Remember, there was two of them going on, total of them $800 million. He won $450 million. He took a cash to $280 million. And how old? You know how old he was? Did you see his picture? 20 years old. And you look at him, he looks younger than Dane. And you're not even 20 yet, are you? I mean, any baby face, and he goes, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to follow my passions. Well, what are they? I bet he doesn't. And I'm going to help make the world a better place. Well, that's a nice thing. $280 million. I don't know what the taxes were going to be. That's Solomon. So what do you mean that's Solomon? He said, well, we're going to ask the question, what qualifies him to ask this question and give us an answer? Is that a fair question on our part? Who are you to tell us when the end is all said and done that this is the answer that we should accept? So that's what we want to do here. But when we do that, look what he says in chapter 2 and verse 11. Go ahead and turn there and read that. Someone read it for us. Go ahead, Brian. This is going to be the theme verse of the entire book, okay?
Chapter 2, verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and was grasping for the wind, for there was no profit under the sun.
So see this summation? When I looked at all my activities, when I just look at everything I've done from my youth up, all the work, all the labor, and when I looked at it, all was vanity. Every last bit of it. It was like striving after the wind. Like, maybe this will make me happy. And you chase it for a while. Then when you finally get it, has happiness, is it in your grasp? Or has it eluded you once again? So you go, oh, man, if I just have this. And you chase it for the next 2-3 years. And boy, if I just have that, then I'm going to finally be happy and content. And when you get there, has it eluded you once more? It's like chasing, grasping the wind. So that's why he says, there's all is vanity. There's no profit or advantage under the sun. You say, man, again, this sounds depressing. Why do I listen to it? You got to just come back because this is going to affect all of us. Now, the problem with life under the earth is this word hebel or hebel. Now, if you take the B out and add an L, that's what a lot of people would say, right? Okay, some of you followed that. That's the Hebrew word for vanity. And there's three characteristics of that word. It's life is brief. He'll talk about life on this earth using vanity. It's just brief. You're just here like a vapor. You said coming from Albany was all foggy, right, Jared? Now, fog is in the morning, but when he leaves and goes home, where will that fog be?
Dissipated.
It's just like your life is like a vapor, James says, like fog. It's here for a little while, but when it's under the sun evaporates and you're gone. Now, that's your life, just whew, gone. And then we'll also see it's absurd. In other words, wait, the wise man does this, he dies. The fool, the evil person, he lives a life with no concern about anyone else but himself. And he sometimes has a good life, but yet he dies. Both the wise man and the fool, they both what?
Die.
Is that fair? No, it's not. But that's the way it is. And he starts comparing things and look at him and says, it's all vanity. So, all good, so I can just be a fool. Oh, no, don't go there. But he says, without a God, when you look at it, it doesn't matter if you're good or bad, rich or poor, an idiot or a wise man, because you all end up to suffer the same fate. And that's why he says it's meaningless. The word hebel occurs 35 times in 29 verses. So it's a predominant theme, and you have to understand that theme. Life under the sun, 29 times. Life without God is always what?
Vanity.
It's worthless. It's empty. Okay? So Solomon, help us, because I want to know how come you are the person that can give us such an astounding conclusion that it's going to force us to look elsewhere for meaning in life. Well, first of all, how do we know it's Solomon? The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, did David have more than one son? Yes. But who is his only son that became king in Jerusalem? It was Solomon. So there are people that try to question it, but it's just pretty much universally accepted that Solomon is the author of this book, okay? He says the preacher. This is the word a koheleth, which means preacher. In fact, the Greek title of this Hebrew letter, because the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, And when they translated it into Greek, they used the word ekklesia, the form of it in the title, which means assembly, because the preacher is a person that would preach to assemblies, all right? And so he was a speaker expounding wise things and wise truth. Some would say it means a philosopher, you know, a lover of wisdom. Now, that seems to fit really perhaps even better what Solomon's doing here. He says, I set my mind to seek, to learn. I want to find out the answer to life. And he's going to use every resource he has available to him. And now, say, okay, what kind of resources do you have, Solomon, to qualify you to do this research project? Because this is going to be a grand experiment in life. We'll look at that in just a second. Wayne. Okay.
Because this writer has gathered all of these life experiences that we're about to look at that journey.
Right. And then he's going to give you a conclusion about what they mean. That's right. So he is going to be able to do what you and I would never be able to do ourselves. And that's what I want to show now. So let's look at a couple verses. First of all, 1 Kings chapter 4. We're going to look at the whole section. 1 Kings 4. Now, Solomon was approached by God, and God asked him, just make a request, and whatever it is, I'll give it to you. Now, it's not like the genie in the three wishes, right? But if you had a genie in the bottle, I know you've all thought about, what would you ask for first? Now, I know if you're honest, when you were younger at least, all of you asked for money, didn't you? You thought, oh, I'd ask for money first, okay? And then maybe I would ask for good looks and then more athletic ability than Michael Jordan, Brett Favre, and who else combined, you know? That's what a guy would do, right? Yeah, you're loud because you know it's true, okay? So that's not what Solomon asked. What did he ask for? Wisdom. He realized, this job's way over my head. How am I going to rule over this mighty nation of people? So he asked for wisdom. So God says, I'm going to give you wisdom. Wisdom more than anyone else has ever had before you and after you. And since you didn't ask for money, I'm going to give you more wealth than anyone's had as well. You're going to get it both because you asked wisely. Okay. So when we look at that, we're going to see what qualifies him to make this investigation. So we're at verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding, enlarged his heart like the sand on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom exceeded the wisdom of all the men of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezraite and Heman and Chalcol. Now, we don't know who these people are, but when it was written, did they know who he was?
Yeah.
He'd be like, say, this is wiser than Socrates or Plato or... Okay, yeah, there you go. And the sons of Methuel, the fame was in all the surrounding nations. So not just in Israel, the other nations knew about him. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop, the springs of the wall. He spoke also of the animals, of birds, of creeping things, of fish. And men of nations, from the kings of the earth, who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Now, what I want to point this out to you is, someone suggested, since his prayer was in the context of how am I going to rule, I need wisdom, he was given political wisdom, managing a nation and running, you know, a country. But here it says what? He was a botanist, wasn't he? I mean, he explored nature and physics, and we're going to see in chapter 2 and following that he looks at everything, engineering. He looks at pleasure and women and alcohol and everything. This guy loses it in many ways. It's really a midlife crisis. But he has the wisdom to test it and weigh in the end like, that's stupid. And so you're going to be able to learn from his experiences what not to do and what to do without doing it. And that's going to be so invaluable because they said, a wise man learns from his own mistakes, right? Like, boy, that hurt. I just walked out of that door up there, and I turned the light off, and I had the door in my hand like this, and I pulled it shut. I didn't pull the handle. You're laughing because you know what happened. It's a heavy door, and when you pull the handle and it hits the door frame, what's in between the door and the door frame? My fingers. You know, I didn't say ouch because I was tough and I knew you were in here. Now, you learn from your mistakes. If I do that again, what do you know? I'm a fool. Right? Now, even a wiser person learns from the mistakes of somebody else. We were having this conversation while our youngest kid was never spanked much, and then the answer was, same reason I wasn't spanked a lot. It's not because I was a perfect kid. Okay, that's one reason. It's because I learned from my four siblings, don't do that. When you have lots of elders and brothers and sisters, you learn, don't do that. And so you learn from their mistakes, and that's how you get wisdom, right? So we have that ability to learn from Solomon as we read this book, all right? Yes?
The other key advantage is he had the financial resources.
All right, you guys. You're exactly right. So let's look at that. 1 Kings chapter 10. Brian's exactly right. He said he had the wealth to do it. Because it's one thing to say, well, I want to try this. You know, if I could fly around the world and do anything I wanted financially, then I think I'd be happy. Have you ever said that? Our son, one of his goals when he was in college and in between college and work and marriage, he was going to travel to every major league ballpark in the United States and watch a game in each one. Then I'll be happy, all right? And I know we've told ourselves, if I could just have enough money to do this, then I could experiment and try and do what I really, my heart's desires, then I would be happy. And I'm trying to show you here, Solomon had the money to do anything he wanted, anything. All right, so chapter 10, and we'll read verse 23 and 24. And then we'll look at one more. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. People would bring him gold and silver. He was rich in trees and livestock and land holdings. Verse 24, all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God has put in his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, mules, a set rate year by year. Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots. That's a lot of chariots, personal chariots. I don't know if they're for his army. 12,000 horsemen whom he stationed in the chariot cities. He built cities to hold the chariots. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones. Did you read that? Now, I've been to Israel. There are stones and rocks everywhere. And here, I know it's a figure of speech, but silver was as common as stones. In other words, it didn't have much value because there was so much of it. And he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores as the lowland. He had horses from Egypt. The king's merchant brought them in Keva at the current price. The chariots were imported from Egypt. They cost 600 shekels of silver. And it goes on and on and on. Did Solomon have wealth? It says in 2 Chronicles 9, every year he received 25 tons of gold. I didn't do the math, but you can. Is that a lot of money? Now, let's put this together. You're king. Do you have authority? You're the wisest man in the world at that day. Everyone's coming to you for wisdom. And you, if not the richest, you're one of the richest individuals in the world. Now, the founder of Amazon, what's his name? Bezos. How much is he worth now? $105 billion. That's a lot of cash, isn't it? Can he do anything once? So I want to start a space exploration program. Could he do that? Oh, yeah, some are doing it. All right? Anything you want, that's Solomon. You're 20 years old. You just got a $450 million lottery. Can he do anything he wants, that kid, right now? I feel sad for him because most kids that age won't be, it'll ruin him probably. I'm on record saying it, okay? But that statistics show that. But Solomon has the authority, he has the wisdom, and now he has the wealth. What else does he need to go on this grand experiment to find out the meaning of life? What else does he need? Well, he has the desire because he has the midlife crisis, all right? He has the itch, right? And he has the time. That's right. And he's going to do it, and that's what we're going to follow. Yes?
In just in wrong alone, something to calculate, 188 tons. And the book of Ezra says that bronze in those days was equal in value to gold. So that works out to be about 6,700,000,000.
Yeah.
Just on the.
In the bronze. Because remember, he did that little presentation of the wealth of Solomon. It's astounding. So when we put it all together, is he qualified to do this grand experiment? Yes. On every aspect. And if we're going to be wise, we're going to listen and learn from his mistakes and his experiences. Yes. That's why
he
go ahead.
Chose to worship other gods. He was sucked in by his wives. He didn't learn. So
that's
I don't,
right.
That part I have always struggled with.
If you didn't hear that, and it's for the sake of the tape, but the question is, there's a conflict here. The wisest man in the world, he ended up messing up his personal life, messing up his spiritual life, worshiped false gods, had 700 wives, 300 concubines. He went over the deep end. And so some have suggested that he started this in his 40s. He wrote this at the end when he kind of came to his senses because he did go over the deep end in many ways. There's no denying that. And so if you put this at the end of his life, and we're going to look at the ultimate answer in a second, it kind of makes sense then when he says in chapter 12, when it's all said and heard, the sum of all, every answer is this, fear God. He woke up. He wasted his life basically trying to find happiness in women, wine and song and money and all those things. Does that help? That's the only way I can.
All my life I've struggled with that.
Yeah. Yeah, because he's searching. He's searching. Yeah. And it's one thing to have wisdom and be able to have self-control. So notice chapter 2 and verse 1. Come now, I will test. This is that test. It's an experiment. And he's going to test, like I said in chapter 2, he's going to test building and architecture. He's going to test drugs. He's going to test sexual pleasures. Nothing's off limit to him. Because how is Solomon living? Life under the sun as if there is no God and no consequences. See, that's his first big mistake, right? And his answer is going to be it's all vanity. So pleasure, materialism, fatalism, egoism, these are kind of the isms people put on. He tests religion and wealth. And when it's all said and done, we're going to see his answer. But he said it's a grievous task. I set my mind. And I've seen all the works. So in other words, I've seen it all. No one needs to repeat my experiment. It was hard, but I did it. And it's all vanity. But what about then life above the sun? Because when you look at life under the sun, and the only answer everywhere you look is vanity, what must that force you to do? Look up. Because this question is always looking down. And what is so powerful about Ecclesiastes, when it's all said and done, if you're an honest person and look at it and you accept what his conclusions are, you're going to look up as well. Mm-hmm. There's got to be more because this earth is not going to satisfy. Now, real quickly, then I'll take your comments, okay? The answer is given in chapter 12 and verse 13 and 14. There's going to be another couple other places, but he says the conclusion. When it's all been said and heard, every discussion, every input, you pile it all up, is this. You look up. You fear God and you keep his commandments because he's going to hold you in account or in judgment for everything you do on this earth. And that's going to now dictate how you live this earth because you know you're going to face him someday. That is the answer that's going to give you happiness in this life. Look up, quit looking down. And that's where we're going to go. And you say, well, that doesn't seem powerful, impacting to me now. Well, when at the end of the study, it will be. Okay? So, Clinton, you had your hand up. Who else?
Go ahead. Somebody don't know about God or the Bible or anything, that's what I said.
It's a And I appreciate that he said it's a good place to send people that don't think about God. But the problem is Ecclesiastes is hard to understand. It's hard to understand unless you understand the context, because humanists and atheists like quoting out of Ecclesiastes. Because they think, ha, you know, it's a heathen secular book, and they quote out. Isn't that sad? Because they miss this grand experiment that's taking place. Solomon's not saying there is no God. He's looking at life as if there was no God and seeing if you could find an answer. See, and they miss that. So, yeah, if you're going to share this with people, you have to kind of help them through the context of how it's asked. Anything else? Okay, next week. Yes, Phoebe.
It's the opposite life of Jesus.
Oh, yes.
Jesus was tempted
in everything. She said it was the opposite of life in Jesus. Of course, him coming from the third heaven and became flesh, having all treasures of wisdom and knowledge, he knew how to live a good life. And he said, I came to give you life and life more abundantly. All right, thank you very much. Come back and we'll start our study.